I'm Tom Hall, and this is Midday. With the exception of the boost in popularity that George W. Bush enjoyed after 9/11, Donald Trump is the most popular president with his party in the last 50 years. In his new book, Politico's chief political correspondent Tim Alberta chronicles the inside conflicts and eventual transformation of the Republican Party from the end of the Bush presidency through the era of Trump. How is it that some of Mr. Trump's most vocal detractors are now counted among his most vigorous supporters? Does Trump's single-minded commitment to his base offer a blueprint for the future for others who aspire to high office? Will Trumpism survive Trump? The book is called American Carnage: On the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. Tim Alberta joins me today on Midday after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. So with the passing of Labor Day, we recognize the unofficial passing of the summer season and a ratcheting up of the presidential campaign season. As the race for the White House lurches into high gear, today my guest is Tim Alberta. He's the chief political correspondent for Politico, and he's written a terrific book about the recent history of the Republican Party and the many internecine ideological and strategic battles that have raged within the GOP ever since the presidency of George W. Bush. The book is assiduously researched and reported. It includes interviews with some of the major players in American politics, including President Donald Trump, former House Speakers Paul Ryan and John Boehner, former White House Chief of Staff and RNC Chair Reince Priebus, and scores of others. Tim Alberta's book has been quoted and referenced in lots of articles and broadcasts on politics since it was published a couple of months ago, and it has been a must-read for Washington insiders, political junkies, and anyone who's ever pondered how Donald Trump has engineered such a dramatic transformation of the Republican Party and the conservative movement in America. It's called American Carnage: On the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. Tim Alberta joins us for the hour from the studios of NPR in Washington. We'll take your calls in a little bit for now, but for now, you are welcome to join us via email or Twitter. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for this book. This is just plain and simply one of the finest political history and political theory books I've ever encountered. So congratulations on it. I'm glad it's doing so well. It's high up there on the New York Times bestseller list, as it deserves to be. But reading it was kind of like reading Alice in Wonderland, in that you point out the incredible evolution, the transformation of so many people who were just vehemently opposed to Donald Trump. Mike Pence, Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, Paul Ryan, and many others. Eventually, they jump on the Trump train. But it's not just political expediency that animates those transformations, is it?
No, not entirely. I do think, of course, political expediency explains an awful lot of anything in the political realm. There is an appetite and an instinct towards self-preservation that informs decisions made on a daily basis by any number of political figures, from the President of the United States to a local city council member. These folks want to keep their jobs, and to keep their jobs, they have to sort of figure out who it is that elects them and what those people want. And in the case of many Republicans, they came to realize pretty quickly that what most of these folks wanted back in their districts, back in their states, was for Donald Trump to remake the Republican Party in his image rather than, you know, cleave to some of the old conventions, the stuffy Republicanism of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush that was predicated on, you know, Wall Street Journal editorial board, free market, think tank conservatism. People were looking for something more visceral, something a bit more, you know, I don't necessarily want to say a little bit more, you know, ugly, because I think in some cases there were plenty of Republicans, you know, both in the elected official class and Republican voters who held their nose as Donald Trump was their nominee and voted for him in spite of some of his ugly rhetoric. But it was, without question, appealing, the fight that he was taking to many in the Republican governing class throughout that 2016 primary. And by the time he emerged victorious as the nominee, and certainly once November came around and he defeated Hillary Clinton, there was a clear choice for many of these Republicans to make. It was, you know, do we continue to hold out? Do we wage this war for the heart and soul of the Republican Party moving forward, refusing to get on the Trump train, as you said, or do we join forces with him? Do we throw ourselves in with him and attempt to have some influence, some modicum of control over the direction of the party now? Because if we stay on the outside throwing stones, we know what's going to happen. We're going to get steamrolled by this guy. But if we can cozy up to him, if we can get on the inside, then we have the ability to help shape policy and help influence outcomes. And so I think that those are the two sides of the coin. On the one hand, many of these Republicans in Washington did, out of just political self-preservation, because they are afraid of Donald Trump and they are afraid of crossing him, they are afraid of what will happen back home in their districts and in their states if they get on his bad side. Yes, many of them for that reason got in line. But I think the other part of it, which is equally important to recognize, is that many of these Republicans were trying to make lemonade here. They understood that this man was just elected president of the United States and that there was a Republican supermajority a Republican majority both in the House and in the Senate. And if they were going to accomplish any of their long-held policy goals, then they were going to have to form something of an uneasy alliance with him in order to accomplish those things.
And you point out that Trump's ascendance didn't happen in a vacuum. There was some fertile ground going way back. I mean, for even much of Clinton's presidency, through both Bush terms, George W. Bush terms, and of course, Barack Obama comes to the presidency in the middle of an economic crisis. But you say that the electorate and the representatives, the folks in Congress, were hardened by a combination of class warfare, zero-sum legislating, and cultural polarization that made it possible for Trump's message to not just break through, but to dominate the 2016 election.
That's right. If you were to, you know, go back 20 years, hop in the DeLorean and go back to the year 1999, it would be impossible to imagine that somebody like Donald Trump running on this hard-edged message of you know, economic populism and really sort of, you know, appealing to the base instincts on the right in a very culturally and socioeconomically bifurcated nation, and sort of preaching us versus them and using a lot of this really nasty vitriolic ad hominem rhetoric, it would be impossible to imagine that this person would even be taken seriously, much less would have a fighting chance to win a major party's nomination and then go on to win the presidency. And as I try to explain in the book, you know, 20 years ago, the country was just so fundamentally different. Obviously, the country was peaceful and the country was prosperous. And so just at a baseline level, those are not the ingredients necessary for, you know, demagoguery and for nationalism and nativism and protectionism to really take root. But also, it's worth recognizing how different the cultural landscape was and how different the media landscape was. I mean, today, you know, somebody says something in Congress on the House floor and it rockets across the world in a matter of, you know, 30 seconds, and everybody can weigh in on it, and people are opining from their respective echo chambers. And there was just not that sort of news environment, not that sort of information environment 20 years ago, really not even 15 or 12 years ago. And I think it's impossible to quantify just how much that has changed the political discourse and how much it has reshaped the political climate. But it's just hugely important to recognize that even when Obama was elected in 2008, you know, social media was in its infancy, and by and large, the country, even after 8 years of George W. Bush, was still, I mean, we think at the time that the country was very divided, but we look back on it now and we think, geez, those were the good old days. And It's even worth keeping in mind that after the Supreme Court essentially handed George W. Bush the presidency, ending the Florida recount, we think about how divided the country felt at that time. But George W. Bush took office as president in January of 2000 with a very, very high approval rating, higher than his father took office with, higher than Ronald Reagan took office with. So the country has changed and certainly has become so much more polarized in such a short period of time due to a combination and really an aligning of these different factors that Donald Trump sort of walked into a situation that was tailor-made for him, and I think in a way that we didn't really fully appreciate until after he had won the presidency.
My guest is Tim Alberta. He's the chief political correspondent for Politico magazine. The book is called American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday, and we are happy about that. Tim, you do remind us, because it wasn't all that long ago. It's just 10 years ago that Barack Obama was inaugurated. In January 2009, MySpace had more monthly web traffic than Facebook. Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie were the most famous couple on earth. Airbnb had just started. Tiger Woods was the most dominant athlete. Uber didn't exist. No one had even heard of the word gluten. And the Twitter account at Real Donald Trump had not yet been created. So this did happen relatively quickly. I mean, there were some predecessors whom you write about. When I think about a person like Sarah Palin, for example, or even the paleo conservative Pat Buchanan, they crashed and burned. They fizzled out. Why is it that Mr. Trump has not fizzled out? His popularity is stronger than ever.
That's a great question. Well, as I mentioned a minute ago, you know, there are certain prerequisite ingredients that are necessary for a message like President Trump's to really gain traction and to really have mass appeal. So you saw with Pat Buchanan when he challenged George H.W. Bush in 1992 that he was called Pitchfork Pat, and this message of economic nationalism, railing against illegal immigration and even mass legal immigration, calling for sort of a return to populist economic policy, rejecting the notion of free trade. Pat Buchanan did gain something of a cult following, but it was never more than, you know, say 20%, maybe 25% at, to put it most generously, of the Republican electorate, of the conservative base. And he was viewed as someone who was, you know, for all intents and purposes, while he was respected as a thinker and as a historian and as a political strategist, Pat Buchanan's philosophy, Pat Buchanan's ideology was not considered to be within the political mainstream. Same with Sarah Palin. When Sarah Palin bursts onto the scene in 2008, chosen as John McCain's running mate, she really does animate some not insignificant portion of the Republican base with her rhetoric about immigration, with her rhetoric about, and you could even take Sarah Palin and place her in a slightly separate category from Buchanan, because Buchanan was widely regarded to be a very serious thinker and really quite a scholarly individual, somebody who had written several books, had thought a great deal about these policies he was advocating. Sarah Palin was sort of Pat Buchanan light in the policy department, but what she lacked in policy chops, she more than made up for in cultural grievance. And so much of Sarah Palin's appeal was railing against the elites in America and railing against, you know, the country club atmosphere, the faculty lounge, talking points, the people in America who felt that they were better than people like her and her family who lived simply in Alaska with her husband working, you know, on the oil rigs and driving snow machines, right? And that ability to sort of tie a political argument to a cultural grievance was what made Palin such a phenom at that time. But even again, Palin, like Buchanan, had a ceiling because the atmosphere just was not yet ripe for somebody like that to have mainstream appeal, to really be taken seriously as a viable political figure. But you fast forward 8 years, and the Republican base, as angry and animated as they were in 2008, they still nominated John McCain, somebody who was thought to be both, you know, ideologically and temperamentally very much out of step with that Republican base that loved Sarah Palin so much. But when you go through 8 years of the Obama presidency and the economy is still limping along, and culturally, many of these Republicans, and socioeconomically, I should add, still feel like they are being really left behind by this country, that this country, by virtue of its demographic changes, by virtue of how the economy is transforming and leaving so many people in middle America behind, particularly people without college educations. A lot of folks were, by the end of Obama's presidency, just mad as hell, and they weren't going to take it anymore, and they were ready to throw all political convention out the window. And when Donald Trump came down that escalator and started hurling insults and started essentially running a campaign that was based far less on specific economic policies and more based on that political grievance and on that cultural grievance, he really met the moment in that way.
Tim Alberta is the chief political correspondent for Politico. His new book about the dramatic changes in the Republican Party that led to Donald Trump's election and his enduring popularity among Republicans. It's somewhere in the 90 percentile, as I recall. The book is called American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. We'll have more with Tim Alberta after a quick break. You are welcome to join us when we come back. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us @MiddayWYPR. You can follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio. Member supported 88.1. WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Midday at the Movies. Jed Dietz, the founder of the Maryland Film Festival, and Anne Hornaday, the film critic for the Washington Post, will join me. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will have a preview of what's coming up this season in theaters here in Baltimore and in Washington. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. And looking ahead to next week, we'll be broadcasting live from the Enoch Pratt Central Library a week from tomorrow, Thursday, September 12th. You are welcome to join us in the audience at the Pratt for that special broadcast, in which we'll learn about all the newly renovated building stuff that's going on down there and all the new programs that will accompany this major multi-million-dollar makeover to one of our city's great treasures. So come to WYPR.org and reserve your free ticket for Midday Live from the Pratt next Thursday at noon. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Tim Alberta. He's the chief political correspondent for Politico. We're talking about his best-selling new book, American Carnage, on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. To join us, you can give us a buzz at 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org, and you can send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. So, Tim, in terms of the appeal of Mr. Trump for his style, his sort of, as you say, his single-minded commitment to those one or two issues that his base very much cares about, to the neglect of everybody else. In terms of that appeal versus the appeal of his actual agenda, you say that Mr. Trump has accomplished more for Republicans than any individual in 30 years. The tax law, of course, we don't yet know perhaps the full extent of whether or not that will end up being a benefit or a detriment to the economy writ large, and judicial appointments in particular. 20% of all seats on federal appeals courts, and that number will get higher, because the Senate has, as you point out, they have very little else to do but appoint, you know, or approve judges. How do you, having talked to Mr. Trump, having talked to people like John Boehner and Paul Ryan, who, you know, certainly are no fans of Mr. Trump, how do you parse the difference or the importance of each of those two sides of the Trump coin, what he has accomplished politically and his style?
Boy, it's a good question. You know, in a way, I think it's tough to distinguish between them. And I say that not to suggest that the president is playing four-dimensional chess and that he is a strategic genius. I think there are two lazy oversimplifications of the Trump presidency and of the Trump political phenomenon. One is that he is a savant who's playing four-dimensional chess and who's always five moves ahead of everyone else. And the other is that he's a bumbling idiot who just keeps stumbling into success accidentally. I think those are both gross oversimplifications. But I do think that there is a certain mad genius in what Trump continues to do on the cultural side, on the behavioral side, on the temperamental side of his presidency. What I mean by that is, you know, the American presidency is unique in certain respects, and one of them is that they are both the head of government and the head of state. And if you were to look at what the president has done as the head of government in terms of just policymaking and not only the bills he has signed, but the enormous amount of executive power he has demonstrated in terms of everything from agricultural policy to deregulation of certain elements of the economy, to climate, to abortion policy, to religious liberty, the list goes on. What the president has done as head of government and working in concert with the Republicans in Congress has been something that will leave a legacy no matter what he does as the head of state. Now, what he has done as the head of state is what makes Republicans very uneasy, many Republicans on Capitol Hill very uneasy, in terms of the Twitter feed, in terms of the press conferences, in terms of the erratic behavior and the ad hominem insults. A lot of what the president has done as head of state is what keeps Republicans on Capitol Hill up at night and afraid to check their smartphones, worried about the next Twitter alert that's going to pop up on their phones. However, because the president's behavior, because the president's work as head of state draws so much attention, there are many Republicans who subscribe to a belief that what it does is effectively distracts and deflects attention away from what he is doing as head of government. In other words, if this were a President Jeb Bush or President John Kasich or President Marco Rubio, many Republicans believe that they would be advocating many of the exact same policies that have passed during the Trump presidency. But because there would be no daily distraction, no shiny object constantly diverting the attention of the American people away from those policies, that the fights, both in Congress and at the battle box, would be waged around policies instead of being waged around personality, instead of being waged around behavior, instead of being waged around rhetoric. And if you talk with many leading Democratic strategists, including the folks who are trying to guide these presidential campaigns for the Democratic nomination in 2020, they will tell you that makes them very nervous because they think it's very difficult to defeat Donald Trump on his own playing ground. They think it's very hard to win an argument that's based around policy, personality, that's based around behavior, that's based around temperament and rhetoric and fitness for office. They think it's actually much easier to try and win an economic argument, to try and win a policy argument with Donald Trump. And he does have this ability, this uncanny ability, to draw his opponents into these name-calling matches or these personality contests, and that's exactly what he would like to do, both with Republicans who step forward to challenge him and certainly with any Democrat who is going to emerge as that party's nominee in 2020.
Yeah, he wants to set the parameters for this for the 2020 election. And as Rubio found out, as Bush found out, as Cruz found out the last time, when they try to engage on that, you know, sort of scornful, discourteous level, it just doesn't work out well. You say that it's an open question as to whether the Democrats will be reborn in the populist convention-shattering mold of people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. We'll see as the Democratic primary process plays out. But you say that on the Republican side, that question has been asked and answered. So this is a done deal. So where does that lead? Or leave the people like, you know, Bill Weld and Joe Walsh, who are launching perhaps quixotic attempts to defeat Mr. Trump in a primary, or the neocons and the traditional conservatives, the George Wills and the Bill Kristols of the world, who have long ago abandoned the Republican Party. I mean, it's a done deal just for 2020, and then does the whole thing change if Mr. Trump is reelected? Does the whole thing just stop in 2024?
I think for the Bill Welds and the Bill Kristols and the George Wills of the world, you could almost envision them as folks who have run under a storm shelter and are clinging to, the metal poles that are holding up a really wobbly pavilion tent as the rains are just thrashing against them, and they're holding on for dear life and just hoping that at some point it passes. And it will pass. Nothing is permanent in politics. We know that. We recognize that everything we have experienced in this young country's political history is ephemeral, and it is cyclical, and there are trends that will take root and seem as though they are here to stay, and that nothing will ever be the same again. And then 15 or 20 years later, they're gone with the wind. And so the question is how durable Trumpism is, because we know that President Trump himself will not be in office forever. He won't be alive forever. He will not be around to dictate the terms of the Republican Party circa, 2060, right? There will be several reinventions and iterations of the Republican Party over the next 40 to 50 years, of course. The question is, This populist, nationalist, nativist appeal that the president has so effectively tapped into, how durable is it? And is it only, maximized at times of real economic instability? Or, as we're seeing the economy continue to improve now, is there a corollary or an inverse relationship between the state of the economy and the appeal that that nationalist nativist message has? I think the question Republicans have moving forward, certainly if Donald Trump loses re-election, but even if he wins re-election, the groundwork will begin to be laid for those 2024 Republican presidential campaigns almost immediately, regardless of whether Trump wins or loses in November of 2020. The question for a Marco Rubio, for a Ted Cruz, for a Nikki Haley, for a Tom Cotton, for any number of these young Republicans who look in the mirror and see a future president of the United States, they have to figure out, how do I marry some of that Trump populist appeal without crossing over into the ugly side, the dark side of that populist appeal? Because when done properly and when channeled appropriately, some of Trump's instincts are very healthy for a political party. There is no question that the Republican Party of George W. Bush and of George H.W. Bush and of Ronald Reagan really was a country club elite party, a party that believed that everything was going to trickle down, that if the stock market was doing well and if the Wall Street Journal editorial page were endorsing it and if the Fortune 500 companies were hiring, then that must mean everything is swell. And there really was a willful ignorance of the discontent and the hurt and the damage that was being felt all across the country, and certainly concentrated among some of their working class, blue collar conservative voters who were looking around saying, why don't these people care about me? Why don't they try to cater any of their policy making to me? So what Donald Trump shone a light on, in a way, is very, very helpful to the Republican Party in the long term, because never again will they be able to grow so intellectually complacent as to ignore those voters. But again, it's a balancing act, because what Donald Trump did was he weaponized that appeal to a point where it became very damaging to the party writ large, and that damage is going to be felt well after Donald Trump leaves office. There are long-term consequences to what we have seen during this presidency, and the trick for Republicans is going to be to figure out over the next 10 to 20 to 30 years, how do we simultaneously capture and channel some of Trump's appeal to these disaffected and disenfranchised conservative voters around the country while simultaneously turning a page on this chapter of the GOP's story and trying to broaden the tent and make the party more inclusive, more aspirational for everyone, not just Trump's core base of supporters?
On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. My guest is Tim Alberta. We're talking about his book. It's a gem. It's called American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can also send us a tweet at @MiddayWIPR. Tim, we have a question from Desmond in Pikesville, Maryland, who says, the upheaval that occurred in the Republicans happened, as you say, could it also happen to the Democrats, especially if Mr. Trump wins a second term. What are the lessons that the Democrats in this campaign and moving forward, do you think, what are those lessons that they should really take to heart?
Well, look, there is not an exact parallel by any stretch between, you know, the Tea Party that produced Donald Trump ultimately and what you're seeing happen on the left today with the likes of AOC and Ilhan Omar and some of the other young Democratic progressives who are dictating terms on the American left after the House takeover of 2018. However, it is really notable that AOC and some of the others who are making life so very difficult on Nancy Pelosi in Congress right now, these are folks who have been in Congress for less than one full calendar year, and you could make the argument that already they are more influential and that they have a bigger megaphone than does Nancy Pelosi, who is not just the Speaker of the House, but arguably the most effective Speaker of the House in a century. And it's fascinating to watch how sort of institutionally the old power structures have crumbled in such a short period of time, and the playing field has been flattened to the point where a freshman member of Congress can be as powerful and as influential as the Speaker of the House. That is sort of the story of John Boehner's speakership and why he was eventually driven from power. Paul Ryan, the same story. Nancy Pelosi finds herself in a very precarious position right now, all of which is to say that what Donald Trump was able to expose was sort of the complacency and the institutional weakness of the governing class, of the political establishment on the right. And I think what you're beginning to see is many Democrats recognizing that same weakness on the left in the Democratic political establishment, because for all intents and purposes, the gatekeepers have disappeared. Not just the gatekeepers in terms of the media. We use that term a lot, and that is certainly true. Donald Trump found tremendous success in going around the media, you know, engaging the American people directly. And by the way, that's exactly what you've seen the likes of AOC do, when not just when she was running for Congress, but since coming to Congress. She has a bigger Twitter following than any single member on Capitol Hill. And again, she's been there less than a year. That's just extraordinary to think about the ability she has to, you know, create her own channel of communication directly with the American people, directly with the grassroots, and not to mention directly with the media. She recognizes that she can manipulate our coverage because she has that megaphone the same way that Trump had. And so when you think about not just the ability to communicate in a way that is new and that is transformative and sort of you know, leverages power in a way that we have not seen politicians be able to do in the past. But also, when you think about the leaders of a party, we have this vision, and when we think about politics, of the party bosses sitting in that smoke-filled room, dictating who is gonna be the nominee and how the campaign was gonna be run and who was gonna work for them and how things were gonna shake out. That is no more, and I think it obviously has been waning for the better part of, you know, the past 30 years. But really, what you've seen on the right in the past 10 years, in the post-Bush era, you essentially saw the final remnants of a political establishment fall by the wayside. Karl Rove and George W. Bush's political machine essentially evaporated into thin air because this new hard-edged conservative movement sort of wiped it out. And you are beginning to see some of that happen in the post-Barack Obama Democratic Party now. That machine that was built by David Axelrod and David Plouffe and that was used to elect Obama twice, it has now begun to sort of crumble and evaporate into thin air for similar reasons. There is just, I think, such a democratized state of political campaigning and of political activism and of political media today that it's almost impossible to imagine any sort of a top-down hierarchy structure informing outcomes. And so when anybody tells you that Joe Biden is a sure bet to win the Democratic nomination, I think people are less bullish on that today than 6 months ago, I would just sort of scratch my head and say, what on earth would give you that impression? Sure, he could win, but the idea that because he's got the most money and because he's got the most name recognition and because he's got the most establishment support, the idea that those three things that traditionally would give you front-runner status,
yeah, none of those things mattered.
That work out for Jeb Bush?
Exactly. Right? None of that mattered the last time, yeah.
No, and so we're through the looking glass, speaking of Alice Alice in Wonderland, we are just completely through the looking glass now, and it's impossible to imagine us going back anytime soon.
But when you talk about a figure like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she does have millions of Twitter followers, but she only has 500,000 or 600,000 voters. You know, Donald Trump has 64 million voters. And when you talk about the political polarity, you make a really great point. For example, in Michigan, Rashida Tlaib, one of the squad, her platform was abolish ICE. She was for single-payer health care. She wanted to cut all foreign aid to Israel. And 20 minutes away in Michigan, a Democrat named Alyssa Slotkin defeated a Republican incumbent, a guy named Mike Bishop, and she ran as what they called a Midwestern Democrat. She supported gun rights. She was opposed to single-payer health care. She wanted to secure the southern border. She ran as a moderate Republican, you could make the case. And they are, you know, next door to each other, just as John Boehner and Jim Jordan were next door to each other when they served in Congress in Ohio. So the polarity is district by district, and Trump, you know, in terms of the electoral map, Trump has an excellent chance of prevailing in 2020, and I think any Democrat who's nominated is going to have a tough time.
Look, there's no question, you know, to the first point about Tlaib and Slotkin, what you're seeing now in today's Democratic Party is that same struggle that we witnessed over the past 10 years in that post-George W. Bush vacuum that was left in the old Republican Party with, you know, you have these classic, you know, Chamber of Commerce, country club, establishment Republicans who were pretty comfortable with the status quo and who were not hard-edged ideologically, and they found themselves overrun by the forces of the conservative movement and of the Tea Party, and who were armed not only with ideological arguments getting to the right of the modern GOP, but with that cultural grievance, with that class resentment that they were wielding so effectively. And again, this is where I hesitate to make the full parallel with today's left, because I think the big difference is there are far more Alyssa Slotkins in the Democratic Party in Congress right now than there are Rashida Tlaibs. Now, that can change, and it very well might change based on the outcome of the next several elections. But the fact of the matter is, Ilhan Omar and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they were not the members who delivered the majority for Democrats in 2018. As much media attention as they get, you would think that they were the majority makers. But the fact is, they reside in districts that are so deep blue that not even Reagan reincarnate could win there.
Right.
The Democratic majority makers were the Alyssa Slotkins. They were the Haley Stevenses of the world. They were the folks who ran these very moderate, sort of blue dog, centrist Democratic campaigns where they barely mentioned Trump by name, much less talked about impeachment.
Yeah, it was all about health care and other things. Absolutely. Tim Alberta, the book is called American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. We're going to have more with Tim Alberta when we continue after a quick break. We'll try to sneak in a call or two, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us today, Tim Alberta is my guest. In his new book, American Carnage, on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump, Alberta takes a deep dive into the internal conflicts and dramatic changes in the Republican Party that led to Donald Trump's election and his enduring popularity among Republicans. You are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us @MiddayWYPR. We have an email from George who says, today's Republican Party is just Dixiecrats in wolf's clothing. We have another one from Bobby who said, Trump is the logical, inevitable political culmination of AM talk radio and Fox News. He's not a politician. He's a stand-in for right-wing America's favorite talk show host. It's not the Republican Party that's driven us here. It's the fervent American ears and eyes and ratings that have demanded the party reflect the same infotainment of their favorite right-wing mudslinger. We have a call from Marshall in Baltimore. Marshall, welcome to Midday with Tim Alberta.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm calling as someone in my late 30s. I was I'm a former Republican in the vein of like a Brent Scowcroft or a Jim Baker. And as much as I don't want to see Trump reelected, what really scares me is if he isn't reelected and the type of effect this is going to have on the Republican bench, because so many people have hitched their wagons to his star. People like Paul Ryan, who, you know, very clearly was against him at first, but then signed on afterwards. You know, if Trump loses, what Republicans are going to be left to run credibly if Trump is soundly trounced at the polls?
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for that comment, Marshall. And Tim Alberti had a lot of conversations with John Boehner, who at the end of the book, it gets downright fatalistic about what it might take to purge the Republican Party of Trump and Trumpism. He refers to a cataclysmic event. I'm not sure if he just means losing the election or something even worse.
Yeah, and we were talking even more broadly about, you know, what it's going to take to bring the country together and to actually get Americans talking to each other again and kind of break out of this tribalistic environment that we've been descending into for the better part of the past two decades. But look, there's no question, to Marshall's point there, this is going to have to get really, really bad before it gets better. And I think most Republicans recognize that whether Trump loses re-election or if he wins re-election and is in office another 4 years, that what we've seen from the Trump presidency is not viable as a political model. It is, you can't win elections in the America of the not very distant future with, you know, less than 30% of the Hispanic vote, for instance. You can't win with the demographic coalition that got Trump elected. And so that is tied, obviously, to policies and to rhetoric surrounding immigration and other things. And so, obviously, if you believe that this play is not viable, is not sustainable for the long term, then you recognize that eventually, like a franchise that's not built to last with its current players, you're going to have to tear it down and start from scratch. And that means recruiting a lot of new players. And it probably means that for a stretch of time, you're not winning many games. And that's probably the period that Republicans will enter into at some point. The question is whether it happens in 2 years or in 4 years or in 8 years.
You know, you write about the sort of Teflon effect with Donald Trump. Regardless of the magnitude of the outrage, people tend to overlook it. I mean, you have guys like Michael Cohen standing in front of Congress saying he's a bigot, he's a liar. He's, you know, you have Ted Cruz saying, you know, he's a pathological liar. He's never said a true word out of his mouth once in his life. But isn't there also a Teflon effect for the party, for the Republican Party? I mean, what kind of consequences is the party feeling with their lurch to Trumpism? I mean, when you think about what I consider the sort of intellectual vacuity of this repeal and replace ode that they kept singing for years and years without any plausible actual replacement. It was a slogan, it was a bumper sticker, and nobody seemed to care that there wasn't a viable alternative to Obamacare. In the shutdown of 2013, you talked about how people blame the Republicans, but they didn't care. And Mr. Trump himself took full credit for the last shutdown that happened just, you know, a few months ago. It doesn't seem that there's a whole lot of consequences even for the party writ large.
Well, I would disagree on that point specifically, because I think what we've learned in the last 4 years is that what Donald Trump can get away with, nobody else can get away with. What you saw during the election of 2018 was 40 House Republicans lose their seats, many of them in affluent, traditionally suburban Republican districts at a time of booming economic prosperity. It's one thing for a party as Barack Obama's Democratic Party was wiped out in the 2010 midterms when unemployment is in the mid-teens and when there are, you know, tens of thousands of jobs being shed weekly around the country. For an incumbent president's party to take the sort of beating that Donald Trump's Republican Party took in November of 2018, especially concentrated in wealthy suburbs where people are doing really, really well, tells you that something is fundamentally amiss. And you mentioned healthcare. When the Republican drive to repeal and replace Obamacare fell apart, congressional Republican approval rating went in the tank. Paul Ryan's approval rating went in the tank. Mitch McConnell's approval rating went in the tank. You know whose approval rating didn't budge? Donald Trump's.
Yeah.
I think he has effectively insulated himself and in a way distinguished himself from the rest of the Republican Party and from the rest of really the entire professional political establishment, that he is immune to and insulated from many of the trends and the consequences that would afflict any other politician. But I don't think Republicans can count on that same treatment.
Let's go to the phones again to Usha in Bel Air. Usha, welcome to Midday with Tim Alberta.
Hi. I am a physician, and I just want to narrate a little incident over here. When I keep New Yorkers in my waiting room. So this patient walked in, whom I know actually from previous acquaintanceship, and he comes in and he tells me, you're not a left-wing commie, are you? Why do you have that? And he brings in a New Yorker, lays it on the table. He says, why do you have this in the waiting room? He is a diehard Trump fan, and I said he is here to see me for medical reasons. I don't have to explain this. He doesn't have to read the New Yorker. If he doesn't want to read the New Yorker, he can go and put it back and we can discuss his health. But what I'm saying is, many of my patients ask me what my political affiliation is, and I dodge the question. They offer me what their political affiliation is, and they tell me that Donald Trump entertains them. I have colleagues who tell me that Donald Trump entertains them, and he is fun, and they are watching a mad show, a madcap show.
And doctor, by the way, I wonder. Excuse me. I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're running out of time. But I'm interested. As a medical practitioner, does that bit of data, when they come and tell you that Mr. Trump entertains them, does that help you serve them as a physician? Does that give you any insight into what kind of care you need to offer them?
Well, you know, I mean, the care I need to offer them, I have to follow a certain standard of care, unless, and it is medical care. I'm an endocrinologist, so I have to follow their sugars. I have to follow all these things. But it just sets my teeth on edge. I have to forget that it sets my teeth on edge and just concentrate on what are the numbers in front of me and what exactly are they doing. Several of them can be medically not literate, and several of them are also not literate about politics. They are moved by emotion.
Yeah, well, thank you for that call. I appreciate it. And Tim Alberta, you talked to, I guess, Vice President Biden, who mentioned, for example, that there's no longer a place for Republicans and Democratic senators to sit and eat together in the Senate building. There used to be two dining rooms, one that was restricted for only people in the Senate and others where senators could bring in guests. And he lamented the fact that getting the two sides together is nearly physically impossible.
Yes. And I think tying that to what the doctor was talking about, I think it is rather unusual that we find ourselves living in a society now where political opinions and partisan affiliations and those sort of tribal instincts are informing so much of what we do and how we interact with others and where we live and where we buy our groceries and what kind of cars we drive. The demographic and geographic clustering of the electorate is really quite fascinating. And I think whether it's Joe Biden complaining that there is no longer a members-only dining room where people can sit together, or whether it's Marco Rubio talking about how, you know, when he was a kid, regardless of whether you were Republican or Democrat, in his neighborhood, everybody went to the same church and everybody played for the same soccer team. Everybody went to the same PTA meeting. Those common institutions that weave a culture and a society together seem to be falling by the wayside.
Talk about the halcyon days. Tim Alberta, the book is called American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. Tim, congratulations on the book and thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Ann Hornaday, the film critic of the Washington Post, and Jed Dietz, the founder of the Maryland Film Festival. Join me. It's Midday at the Movies. Ann will report from the Toronto Film Festival, and J. Wynn Russick will have a preview of what's coming up this season in regional theater. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank Well Crafted Kitchen for providing lunch today. They're located within the Union Craft Brewing Tap Room. Well-Crafted Kitchen serves up seasonally inspired wood-fired pizzas and eats, all created in-house with ingredients sourced from Baltimore area farmers and producers. Celebrate community through food with Well-Crafted Kitchen at 1700 West 44th Street, or let them fire up your next celebration with the 1949 Dodge Mobile Pizza Kitchen. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is coming up next after news at the top of the hour. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.